That's Jamaica's Monty Alexander at the piano, with Delfeo Marsalis on trombone, with Bob Marley's No More Trouble. That's from Monty Alexander's 2006 album, Concrete Jungle, the music of Bob Marley. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, November the 20th. And whatever the grand jury's decision in the killing of Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, it will be a decision in a case that was put on the wrong track by the very people who proclaimed that they were seeking and still are seeking justice. That's the focus today on Lead Stories. And our guest, the People's Attorney General, Attorney Alton H. Maddox Jr., who has been deconstructing the legal issues involved in this tumultuous case, joins us once again. Delighted to have you with us, Alton. Welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I would say this before we get into the discussion proper, and that is that I wanted you to know that the feedback that I've been getting is that our discussions have served and are serving as a kind of legal classroom. People are appreciating the arguments that are underlying this case and the related case in New York City, that of the chokehold death of Eric Garner, which involves the same personnel as we see in Ferguson. So I want to thank you for making available to us, because this is the whole point. In the cases that I've covered, as you know, Alton, I really like to get to the legal aspect of it, because that's really where the case is, isn't it?
Right. Well, you know, Eutrice, I want to thank everybody for the appreciation of the discussion. However, there is one drawback to it, and that is, I suppose, because of my own take on the law and the way that it should be approached, it is really a financial liability, because I can get no job in any law school. So, you know, nobody's interested in my teaching young people, and especially black law students, how to really approach these courses. And even though I have an impeccable record and, you know, won cases that others said were impossible, but nobody want to hear from me. So in one sense, it's good to hear people say that they're hearing something that is worthwhile. But on the other side of the ledger is the fact that because they are hearing these things, it has also prevented me from having a practice or earning a living.
Well, I think that is something that has to be taken up as a major, major project, and people have to insist on your restoration, and they have to insist that you are worth fighting for as a community project. And I think this is one huge, huge mark against the community for really but maybe it's just simply a matter of direction, and maybe that would happen very shortly. I certainly would like to urge that it happen.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always felt, Eutrice, is that sometimes, and I don't have any regrets in doing it the way that I did it, because it became a matter of emergency. And I didn't think that we could wait. And I suppose Dr. King raised a relevant question, why we can't wait. And when I started practicing law, we couldn't wait. But I was always concerned about the level of the intelligence of the community itself about the law. And, you know, and I've tried to, in every way I could, engage in all kinds of legal programs in addition to the things that we have done to really try to bring us up to snuff. And I suppose one of the things that has really hurt is because of the fact that our people have the wrong conception as to how the law started. I suppose that if people were fully aware of the fact that the notions that are practiced today in American jurisprudence actually came out of ancient Egypt, and many of the concepts that are practiced today were actually shaped by those Egyptians. Now, what has happened is that whites have been astute enough through censorship and dumbing us down to make us unaware of where all these things come from. And then on the other hand, they've been astute enough to shape these principles that fit them and accommodate white supremacy. And, you know, I'm not personally upset at what they have done, because if they believe that they have to prove that they are supreme, then it seems to follow that they would do the things that they are doing to make sure that we all know who is superior and who is inferior. And that's really what we are talking about as we go on with this discussion today, because many of the principles that we will be discussing and have been discussing really came from our own ancestors.
Well, let's take a look here at the situation in Ferguson. We have the Reverend Al Sharpton stepping in very early in this case as the leader on this case, taking the lead on this case in the interest of justice.
Right.
Bringing in with him the attorneys, Benjamin Crump and his affiliate in St. Louis, Mr. Gray, to provide the legal counsel to the family. But very early on, this case started going down the wrong track. And it was, in my view, I don't know how you think about it, but it was, in my view, a deliberate act to put this case seemingly in the public eye. You know, there are all the trappings of, oh, we want justice, no peace, and all of that. But really, when we look at the actions, we see through the acts of omission and acts of commission that this case was destined to be on the wrong track from the very beginning. And by that I mean the absolute failure and the absolute unwillingness to engage the system by serving notice that, number one, there must be a special prosecutor. Only recently, in fact, as recently as last week, do we see Al Sharpton writing an op-ed piece saying, oh, now it's time for us, you know, we should have had a special prosecutor in this case. How do you read this?
Well, you know, Yatrice, and I have to ask you to be patient for a moment to really give the audience some quick history that really explains things. And one is that in June of 1987, there was a meeting of all of the leading activists in the tri-state area, meaning New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, at the House of the Lord Church. And at that particular meeting, it was brought out that Reverend Sharpton was our problem. Now, what is good about that is the fact that we would meet and try to identify where our problem lies, and we would take care of that particular problem. So that was good. The bad part about it, though, is that it was really based on the wrong premise. One, it was based on the fact that we had no code of ethics in our community. And two, it was based on the fallacy that Sharpton, at that moment in 1987, was a greater threat to the black community than Roy Ennis. And so I had to dissent. I was the only person there at the meeting, about 100 people, and all of them leading activists, journalists, ministers, you know, the whole nine yards. And I just said, I have to respectfully dissent because, you know, the problem here is that Sharpton may be a problem, but he's not the problem right now. And I think if we start off on the notion of selective prosecution, we may end up on the wrong foot. So that, you know, if we ignore what Roy Ennis was doing in 87 and we just only get focused on Sharpton, then we got a problem. Now,
we must say who Roy Ennis is.
Well, Roy Ennis was the former head of the Congress of Racial Equality, you know, has been a longtime activist who's been hooked up with the Republican Party. And I suppose you may know more about him than my background, but that's a bird's eye view of Roy Ennis. Right. And so, you know, with that in mind, you know, I just took that position. Now, what is interesting is now is that this is what people who are not in the New York City area would not know under any circumstances, and that's why it's sometimes important to bring them up to snuff. I said myself that I would personally defend Al Sharpton under any circumstances because I felt like our community had to take charge and not be directed by others. And so, you know, the fact that we were doing this was good. The fact that we were doing it because white folks wanted us to do it was bad. And I felt like the people who were actually sponsoring this were people like Bob Abrams, Jack Newfield, and others. And so I took a view that I was going to stand behind Sharpton until the community decided to take him out. Now, the tragedy is that was 1987, and now we're talking about 2014, and Sharpton is still alive and kicking. Now, that's a real tragedy. So my point is that we as a community have to, and you've said this most eloquently when you say that we must be accountable, and we must have some level of accountability, and that's what ethics is about. Bringing about some accountability and also providing some glue that make us all stick together. That's the reason why when black people say, well, black people won't stick together, well, we shouldn't be sticking together because we don't have no glue. There's nothing that glue us together. You just can't stick together unless you have some glue. And ethics is that glue. Accountability is that glue. And so in that sense, the second point I want to make is that the civil rights movement, not R-I-G-H-T-S, but the civil rights, S-I-L-V-E-R-R-I-T-E-S, did not start with Jesse Jackson, with Dr. King, as Jesse Jackson claimed, dying in his arms. It started here in New York City. That's where the civil rights, S-I-L-V-E-R-R-I-T-E-S, and Sharpton was well-versed in that. Because people have to understand, Sharpton is a foot soldier of organized crime. I mean, there's just no question about it. And so he was bringing that to the bear. So what we have now is somebody who is engaged in a protection racket. He is racketeering at our expense. And so that's what has gone down in Ferguson. He was out in Ferguson to protect the white supremacists because that's his business. And they reward him with millions of dollars in order for him to carry out that business of racketeering and providing protection with whites. Now, there's a number of examples I could give to prove without a shadow of a doubt that that's what he does. But suffice it to say, for the question that you asked me, that I will let it reserve and rest right there.
By the time Reverend Sharpton came into Ferguson with the lawyers, it was a month after the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, and we saw the same pattern there. What was so blatantly clear, even to anybody remotely familiar with this kind of case, and what needs to be done in this kind of case, the history that had already been established, the leadership position that they took, which is to say, when Sharpton declared, well, I got this, I'm in charge here, this is my case, what he was also saying is, nobody else need intervene. this, you're off limits, you know, we have this thing wrapped up. But at the same time, they're eliciting the input from the broader community. They're inviting people to march. They're inviting people to register their concern about justice and so forth, which is to say, this case and the Ferguson case and the Eric Garner case, these are by virtue of their position of inviting public participation, means that this now is a public or community property. Mm-hmm. But they had not been acting, and they did not act as if this was community property. If it were community property, if the interest was in obtaining justice for the community and to set precedence so that we know that at least, if nothing else should come out of these cases, at least there is a matter of law to say, and a record to say, we have fought the fight. We have done our job. We have filed the necessary motions. We have done the legal work. In Ferguson, the very name of the officer involved was not known until the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri did that piece of legal work. So we have to ask ourselves the position that for all kinds of purposes, and I suspect that there's a great deal riding on this personally for Sharpton and personally for the lawyers, that this case was allowed by, I say it, by commission and by omission to go down the wrong track. We had in Ferguson the case being fast-tracked to this questionable grand jury process without even the indication by Sharpton and the legal team that they had a reason to demand a special prosecutor, and not just by asking, as I said, it's not saying pretty, pretty, please. It's about filing the necessary legal work to say they are compelling the governor to, in turn, compel the attorney general to, in turn, put in place a special prosecutor in this case. What are your feelings about this?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And let me just sort of lay out something that I can tell you would have worked. And this is why, you know, I'm really upset with a lot of people here in New York, because the people that have claimed to be around me have really only been there to make sure that I could not do anything. And I don't want to name, but they know who they are, and anybody with a blanking brain cell should look at the people who claim to be around me, and they all be able to figure that out. But now, this is the approach that should have been employed, in my humble opinion. The first thing I would have done would have been to bring a taxpayer's lawsuit against the chief executive or the county executive of St. Louis County. I would have sued the mayor of Ferguson, and I would have sued some other people to claim that this was a waste of taxpayers' money. And the reason why this was a waste of taxpayers' money is because I would have shown, and I would have brought it in, accountants and others, and statisticians and people like that, to have shown that we already have probable cause established. That's all you have to do. I mean, you don't have to go, there's nothing that goes before a grand jury that we don't already know. I mean, we know already that Brown shot this man. We know that
it's the other way around.
I mean, I'm sorry. We know that Wilson shot Brown, okay? We already know that. We know that as far as the pathologist reports are concerned, that this is a homicide. That's all you need to know. Because that's the classification. So we've already established that. And then we have eyewitness testimony already. Now, rather than to subject this to a 3 or 4 or 5 month process with a grand jury and bring in, let's say, anywhere from 12 to 23 members, which would be here in New York, and paying them for all the time that they are sitting around during this process, this could have been very easily abbreviated because, A, judges are more equipped to understand the legal terms than members of a grand jury. So you can simply have one judge come in and put the witness under oath, and they offer their testimony. And at the end of the day, the judge himself can decide, or herself, whether there's probable cause or not. And you're talking about the difference between, you know, on one hand, maybe $10,000, and on the other hand, at least $250,000. I mean, so you're talking about a waste of taxpayer service because every fact does not lend itself to a grand jury. And this is what lawyers should have made clear. They should have gone into court and made clear that sometimes the grand jury is necessary. But when you already know what the obvious is, you don't have to go through that process. You can use a preliminary hearing. That's the reason why there is a preliminary hearing for that particular purpose. That was the first thing that should have been done. Now, secondly, what happens is that once you put the governor in a bind, because now he got to defend the waste of taxpayers' money, because that's when people start raising their antennas. Man, what are we doing here? I mean, even though I'm somewhat down with Wilson and all of that, but they do raise a legitimate point here. Why are we wasting all of this money? And at that point, you can begin to negotiate on whether, if you are going to go to grand jury process, maybe that we should just have a special prosecutor along with the grand jury. But to sit back and do nothing, as these lawyers did, really has doomed this entire case, and they are absolutely responsible for any failures that's going to arise after this, because they were ambulance chasers. And while the family has a right, if they want to have ambulance chasers, this is a class action, because we are talking about a class, not two or three people, but we're talking about every person of African ancestry could be similarly situated and affected in some manner about what is going on in this particular case. And the final point is, and I think we all, as members of this class, must recognize that there is an argument in the law that says that if you are a member of a class, you cannot be an innocent bystander. So, you know, for all the people that want to say, well, I don't have nothing to do with this case. No, if you're a member of the class, you cannot be an innocent bystander. I mean, you are part of the class. And see, this is where people get off the hook, because some people say, well, I got a right to decide. No, you don't have a right, because you are an innocent, you are not an innocent bystander, and yet you want to profit from what is given to that class, and that is absolutely unjust. And so, you know, I think that clearly under these circumstances, it was a big mistake for the people to allow these ambulance chasers to come into Ferguson and pervert the criminal process.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I asked you about this question about why didn't this go to a preliminary hearing? Why did it go to a, remember that? I asked you that. And right. I am not a lawyer. So, if I am not a lawyer,
well,
and it
absolutely
strikes me as being odd that this case was being handled this way, I can't imagine, except that this was a deliberate act. I hate to imagine that they didn't know or weren't aware that these were options and that these were challenges that they should have made. No matter how the case comes out, no matter what the decision is by this grand jury, the fact is that it came to the grand jury at all without a fight. Without anybody saying, we've got to have a special prosecutor here, to me is a huge, huge blow to this case.
Well, and you're absolutely right, because you see, the one thing that people miss in all of this, lawyers are involved in a legal process where you have to identify the right causes of action. You know, I mean, you can be suffer a wrong, But if you file a lawsuit based on a wrongful cause of action, then your lawsuit is going to lose because you're supposed to be, as a lawyer, above what the public may know, and the public should be able to hear the different arguments as to what really should apply. I mean, that's why you go to lawyers, because lawyers are supposed to be able to say, well, hey, man, you know, really a grand jury doesn't apply in this case. A preliminary hearing does. Well, that's why you go, because, you know, lawyers are supposed to be capable of doing that. These lawyers or ambulance chasers were not.
The same thing, though, is holding in this other contentious case in the city of New York and Staten Island, where Eric Garner lost his life as a result of a chokehold illegally applied by a police officer, with several other officers assisting. So we have to ask the question then, if Sharpton is in the lead and the lawyers are working in concert with him, what is the incentive for remaining silent on the issue of a special prosecutor from the word go? Because here in Staten Island, we also saw the same progression. In fact, the prosecutor in Staten Island declared that he was going to apply a special grand jury. We talked about that. And without even somebody say, well, wait a minute, you don't have the authority to call a special grand jury. What is this grand jury that you impaneling here to determine whether the police officers will be charged? So we have a consistent pattern of no proactive moves, no attempt whatsoever to disturb the political organization, no attempt whatsoever to register legal objections in these cases, that anybody handling a case of these cases of such magnitude would expect at least a record, that it just did not go well with the people representing the interests of the family.
Well, you know, one thing that, and you're absolutely correct about this, and I think people have to also put on their thinking caps and look at this for what it's worth. Sharpton, even before he got to Missouri, even before he got to Staten Island, he found himself in a lot of trouble with a 70-count indictment, one of which everybody said nobody could win. If they did win it, there were going to be at least some counts in which Sharpton was convicted. I mean, everybody said that. Even Lewis Clayton Jones, who raised Sharpton, publicly said at Bethany and Baptist Church that Sharpton was guilty as hell. So, you know, and Clayton was an astute lawyer, but he was clearly aware of the facts. Now, if you sit somewhere, you know that you are, quote, guilty as hell, and you know that if you went to any lawyer in America, and people can do this on their own by, you know, going wherever you live to the top flight criminal defense lawyer in your state, and asking that person, how much would you charge me to represent me on a 70-count indictment? And the answer would be, at a minimum, $20 million. That's a bargain basement price. So Sharpton benefited from free legal counsel, did not pay a dime for anything, even including parking or anything else, or lunch or whatever the person had to suffer to be down there for 4 months. And he saw the same lawyer beat the state on other occasions and got the two special prosecutors from the state. Well, you know, the question becomes then, well, why wouldn't you ask this man to get involved?
And I think talking about yourself, of course. You should make that clear.
Yeah,
you were the one who defended him.
Right, why wouldn't you ask this man to get involved? I mean, if this man has done all these things that nobody else has done, and, you know, you're going to say, well, I'm going to go with Benjamin Crump. I mean, who we don't even know is a lawyer yet. I mean, you know, other than what he says, I haven't seen any evidence of him being a lawyer. He may be a lawyer, but I haven't seen any evidence of it. I would hope that he's not a lawyer, because I think we could be better represented in our community by people other than Benjamin Crump. And so my point is, why would you avoid all of that and then put the Garner case as well as the case out there in Ferguson, you know, in a straitjacket? I mean, this is what is bothersome, and for our community to sit back there and, like, we can't connect the dots and think outside the box. But, you know, going back, and I said this all along, Sharpton did not learn his craft from Jesse Jackson. Sharpton learned his craft from organized crime. Jesse came into New York later and learned and perfected the practice. It wasn't that, you know, when Jesse got to New York, Sharpton already knew how to run a silverites movement. He already knew that. That's what New York was about. And so when Jesse came here, he learned the deal and then perfected it, you know, and he has gone on. And now Sharpton has gone on. But what we are seeing here is organized crime at work. And, you know, and I'm not going to bring up some of your old nemesis, but, you know, some of the people that when you were writing for the City Sun were also involved in organized crime. And these were some of the leading ministers here in New York City. I mean, so, you know, it's no secret that this town is infested with organized crime figures, and that Sharpton has benefited from that, and that now we are watching one of the top mobsters that America has ever known in operation.
Wow. You leave no wiggle room there at all for the fact that maybe he just was overzealous, or he was just not thinking right, or he felt pressures to produce certain results, and he just was, these things were not in his mind.
Well, you know, he has a lot on his plate, that's for sure. I mean, because he's involved in a million activities all over the country. And the idea that anybody could believe that Sharpton could solve these problems, you know, really raises real concerns about us as a community. And the fact that, you know, I could sit somewhere at the House of the Lord Church in 1987 and tell people, no, I'm going to let Sharpton sick the black community. I'm going to let him suck us for as long as he can of all the, our blood. And now we're talking about in 2014, 27 years later, this man is still doing it. And the question becomes, in no other community could you operate in that way. They will not allow that. And it does not have to be, it shouldn't be done by one person. No long gunman should pick up a gun and blow his brains out. I mean, this has to be a community verdict. And the question becomes, how long are this going to last? And the last time I checked, what Sharpton had done is use the money that he has gotten to pay off a whole lot of other people. I mean, so, you know, it's funny to me that Reverend Daughtry, who in 1987 would convene a meeting to lynch Sharpton, is now one of Sharpton's running buddies. So, you know, this shows you that how he rolls. I mean, this man, you know, is turning everything on his head. And, you know, a lot of people who are not here from here in New York don't ever get a chance to hear this. And, you know, they certainly wouldn't get a chance to hear it from me, because you're probably one of the very few people that would invite me anywhere close to the microphone now to talk about these kinds of things. So, therefore, you know, this stuff is unknown. But this man has been operating for 27 years after being scrutinized by the community. And now he has turned around and bought everybody that was supposed to be against him. They're now on his team. You know, and so this whole thing about the IRS and all of that, you got to ask yourself, how does a man who probably a civil rights activist owe the IRS more than $5 million or more? And we also know that that's just of income that he failed to report. The other income is the money that he's making off the books. You know, that and that's large sums of money. Him and Rubenstein was engaged in racketeering. And that is Sanford Rubenstein, who now they have caught for a moment for rape. And everybody seemed to be quiet about that except me. But this man had been running around raping people and getting away with it. So, you know, and under Sharpton's blessings. So, you know, I mean, it's a real lot of problems here. But why is it that the community itself does not rise up and say, man, enough is enough? You know, we started with you in 1987, House of Lord Church. And now you don't wiggle yourself beyond all of that. And now we're in 2014, and you're still causing havoc.
Well, let's talk about then what is to be obtained in the way of justice in this case. Whatever the decision is there a way to reclaim this case and the case in Staten Island, the Eric Garner case? Is there a way to reclaim, when I say reclaim it, I mean in terms of the pursuit of justice, because we are going to have a grand jury determination there, this so-called special grand jury, which is an abomination already. These two cases, I think, were deliberately allowed to go down these routes because there were arrangements, political arrangements made behind the scenes in order to, you know, this was a midterm election year. The DA in Staten Island, as well as the prosecuting attorney in St. Louis, up for re-election. We have these are high profile cases. We have these two cases involving police attacks and killings of black people. For all these purposes, these cases needed to be clamped down on. They did not need to have these cases explode, although they did. So the role of Sharpton was to put a lid on things, to calm people down, to direct traffic the other way, not in terms of combat with the system, but accommodation with the system, with the assurance, I presume, that at the end of it all, the payout will be pretty substantial on the civil side. But if we're talking here about a systemic yield in terms of advancing the cause of justice, because in the end, this case and all of the other cases, including the Tawana Brawley case, they're all about the same thing. It's all about what rights do blacks have in this country? Are black citizens of this country? It's the same case of Dred Scott. Do we have rights at all in this country?
Right.
And rights to an equal trial.
Let me start with some very simple logic. Oh, everybody listen to this. This is very simple logic. If I was able, out of my own pockets, because when we talk about Office of Private Attorney General, the black community did not give me a dime. And people know that. You know, there was no legal defense fund. There was zero. I used my own money to fight all of these cases in New York. That's a fact. And nobody can refute that. Now, if one man can take on an entire system and turn it upside down, and that system is New York, then the question, it shouldn't even be a question of what I could do in Missouri, all right? It shouldn't even be a question of what I could do in Missouri. Like I told people, look, if I am surrounded by people who are not trying to hold me down, which is where I am right now, And people make a demand for me to stop being judicially bullied, because that's all it is, because there is nothing that happened here. You can't discipline somebody if you don't give them hearing, all right? You know, and so I never got those hearings. That's just a basic thing. The problem that New York legislature had, well, he just really cannot be handled. Now, my question is, well, why don't we let the Missouri legislature have the same problem? If the New York legislature had that problem and I was giving them a problem, then why don't we do it out there in Missouri? Because, you see, I know for a fact that this man out there in Ferguson, Missouri, can be indicted prosecuted and gone before a jury. I know that. All right? So, I've done this before. I've done this work. My problem has been, in just simply being in a position where I can do it. And the problem there is I don't need anybody surrounding me if they're not going to do anything but hold me down. I mean, that's just the point. So all these people that are around me now, please clear out. Please don't be in the office after we finish this program. Please be gone, because I don't need that, because I can do all this by myself. And it's a sad commentary that our community is caught up in a situation where the one person who really wanted the community to bring Sharpton down would have to just get back in the saddle and do it myself. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. That's not going to necessarily cure a problem. That's like a Band-Aid. But at least he won't be around in the future. We can go on to somebody else. And it may take a little while before they can produce another Al Sharpton, because that is something that may take some time to do.
Well, of course, we've been talking specifically about Sharpton's role and the lawyer's role in these two cases, but we are talking by extension about black leadership.
Right.
And the fact that the communities that they, quote, represent, unquote, are so distressed that any kind of leadership, anything that looks like leadership, will do. And they, with great sincerity in their hearts and great hope that these changes can come about, they invest in these leadership, in this leadership, and they cling on to the idea that something good will come out of it. But my contention is that these two cases again illustrate the problem that we have of a compromised leadership, a leadership that is unable to deliver what people really are in need of, which is justice. And they do use these the energy of the community, the investment of the community, for private gain.
Well, one of the things we need to go back to historically and recognize, this is a fact, and it can't be refuted. We did not come out of slavery because of the Emancipation Proclamation, because that was a fraud in the first place. We came out of slavery because there was pressure from A, the Liberty Party, and B, the Free Soil Party, for slavery to come to an end. Not because white folks was upset that we was in chains, but it was because we were affecting the wages that white people could earn. And so it was not in their own personal interest to allow us to continue to work for nothing, and there'll be no wage structure when you got rid of slavery, and the whole wage system would be more attractive to white workers. I mean, that's really what this was. And so my point is that the only way that we're going to really speak as a group is to, as Charles Sumner said, who was a U.S. senator from Massachusetts, is that black people are going to have their own party. We're going to have our own political party. And we got to have our own political voice to be distinct from those others, where we can tell our own story. Now, in that regard, what Sumner said, well, we shouldn't join neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party. We should have our own. So we have done that now. But what the problem there is that you can't get blacks who are committed to having a party and who can turn down any offers of crumbs from Al Sharpton. You know, and so he is head of the Democratic or the Negro wing of the Democratic Party, you know, and so as long as we stay in the same party with him, we are doomed. You know, we have to absolutely leave out of the Democratic Party en masse, because Sharpton has already become the head Negro in charge of the Democratic Party. And, you know, and the problem is that Sharpton is a switch hitter. He's neither Republican nor Democrat. He's green. He officially, not just being a member of the Green Party, but his color is green. And so, you know, as long as we find ourselves in anything that associated with him, it's going to be nothing but problems. You know, like, for example, now, with the story that's not being told is Bill Cosby.
Let me ask you to save that for tomorrow.
Okay.
We'll deal with that. We want to end a little early today, Alton, because we have a little bit of fundraising to do.
Okay, all right.
But I want to thank you so much. Again, this has been very illuminating, and we ought to have these kinds of frank discussions. I said that earlier on. We need to have a series of very, very frank discussions as to where we are within the community and between and among communities. We need to have these kinds of very frank discussions and exchanges. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll pick it up again tomorrow. In studio is somebody, I think he's familiar. His name is Gary Null.
Hi, you trees. By the way, when you talk about Bill Cosby, give me a call, because Bill Cosby's chauffeur for 23 years is a friend of mine, and I have a perspective on that, and also some conversations I've had with Bill Cosby, one-on-one.
Alrighty.
Okay? But what we're here to do today is to help the station, to help your program, and to help the audience. And as people know, listening to PRN, and by the way, this week, according to Jason, the figures are in, and I'll let Jason give you those figures in a moment, about how many people are listening to PRN. We are the number one listened to internet radio station in the world. If you Google liberal radio, we are number one in all liberal radio. That means everything. And we dwarf all the others, Democracy Now! And everyone else, but also number one progressive. And we've never had to have a fundraiser, not once in our 12-year history. Every single one of our 85 hosts and programs are able to do that without the constant pitching that you hear on BAI, for example. We just finished 5 weeks. And by the way, you and I, in the last fund drive that succeeded on BAI, we raised $1.2 million in 14 days. You and I alone did $63,000. In 1 hour, being the all-time number one fundraising hour in the history of non-commercial radio. And we just finished 5 weeks and raised $300,000, of which about $270,000 will be collected, or $250,000 be collected. And that was in 5 weeks. So that shows you what has happened. But here at PRN, we've never done a fundraising. Our goal is never to have to do one. And what I do is occasionally I will offer a book, a video, or product to the listeners, and all that money, every penny, goes to PRN. Today, and by the way, Jason is here, our PRN's program director. Jason, you just looked at the Facebook. How many people are coming and using PRN for their articles, looking at films, listening to radio shows?
Just weekly going to Facebook, just checking our posts out, checking our videos, checking all our pictures out. We're having over 4.5 million people just come weekly just to see that. Then we have on over 14 million minutes on PRN Radio Log on Zena Radio. And then we have over 90 million people going through Google to see PRN and look at our Progressive Radio. We're number one there. So that's an amazing number.
How about those numbers, you trees?
Well, I tell you, I've been watching my own numbers, and from the downloads, I'm close to 425,000 people downloading the program. I'm very impressed with that, considering we haven't mounted, you know, the all-out campaign.
And that's one
this
source.
This is just people
that's just one
telling
source.
Other people.
By the way, that was only one of about 16 sources you were given. You weren't given all
right.
the numbers, just yeah. one. So you have well over 500,000
yes,
people downloaded
Stitcher,
your show.
Still other places.
Yeah, other places you didn't know about. So what
sure.
we're offering today, thank you, Jason, what we're offering today to this audience is something that I'm really concerned about. I'm concerned about we as a public are not prepared for disaster. Now, today in Rochester, in Syracuse, and in Buffalo, 6 to 7 feet of snow, over 9 people dead, electric out, and will be out in some areas because of fallen trees and power lines for a week or 2 weeks, and then people realizing, what do I do? We also had fires all over California now. We had mudslides in Colorado. And behind all this is the idea we never prepare. When a hurricane comes to my hometown down in Florida, Every single thing in the stores are gone. Plywood is gone. Food, fresh food is gone. And water is gone. And that's even with a storm that may last hours and not be that devastating. I'm very concerned about what will be devastating, and that is the solar storm. Now, as a scientist, as a PhD in human nutrition, as a professor, Fairley Dickinson, as someone who's been an Institute of Applied Biology research fellow for 31 years, I can tell you that I'm not impressed by a lot of things and that I can't prove. But one thing I am impressed by is how bad a solar storm can be. It's scary. Just in the last 10 days, there have been 7 major solar flares. You can see these on NASA's satellite imagery of the sun. One of those coronal mass ejections is capable of knocking out, if it's an X factor, all of the electricity where it hits on the planet. That means if it hit in North America, no telephone, no computers, no television, no water, no gasoline, no traffic lights, no credit cards, nothing that works on electricity will work. So what do you do? And what if it's an X storm and knocks out our big, big power grids, which it will? Well, then you may be 3 months minimum to 3 years without electricity. People don't have any idea how bad that is. Every nuclear power plant in the United States has a maximum of 1 week to 4 weeks worth of backup fuel, and that's it. So when those billion gallon of water a day cooling coming into the spent fuel rods is not there, being drawn out of rivers and the ocean, well, then it melts down and you have Fukushima's. And then you've got serious trouble because you're not going to know that a nuclear power plant exploded. You're not going to know that you're being exposed to radiation. You will simply become radioactive and develop radiation poisoning, as 1 million people died from Chernobyl, as we now find from 5,000 scientific articles written in Slavic, that it was that devastating. So what I did was this, knowing that it is inevitable. It's not are we going to, but when we're going to get hit with a solar storm. But if also you're in a situation where you have a flood, a hurricane, a tornado, any other natural disaster hit, where you can't just go out and get food or supplies, I invented what is called survival stuff. Now, this is big. It's a gallon. It's 1,800 grams. And in it, I said, okay, what would I need? What would I personally need each day to maintain my health if there was a disaster of some form? And I didn't have regular food that I could eat. I would need protein, so I got split pea protein and brown rice protein, put it in here. I would need a combination of fruits and vegetables, fibers, amino acids, probiotics. So I put in here alfalfa and pumpkin seeds and flax seeds and barley grass and kale and carrots and cauliflower and cabbage and parsley and ginger and spinach and celery and broccoli and asparagus, collard greens and apple, bananas, cranberries, strawberries, chlorella and spirulina, blueberries and blackberries, raspberries and oats and sprouted grains and oat beta-glucan and chia seeds and 5 types of sea vegetables like area and dulse and laminaria. And 8 billion non-dairy probiotics, the living bacteria that are so important for our health. And then I flavored it with stevia, a natural extract, and natural pineapple and cherry flavor. Now, it's got 17 grams of complete high-quality vegetable protein. It's got 15 grams of high-quality fiber. And it has no cholesterol. And it is exactly what we need. So if there is ever a disaster of any type, at least you will have what you need in order to survive. And never underestimate the indifference of the average person to disaster. Well, it's never going to happen. And then it does. And then you're sitting there thinking, why didn't I prepare? So you never want to use a fire extinguisher, but you never want to be foolish enough not to have one. You never want to use your health insurance, but you want to know if you do have a sickness or an emergency, it's there. You know, like if you're rich, like Bono, who was just in a motorcycle accident yesterday, crashed up his face and broke all these bones in his body, he can afford it. What if you were in that same accident? He didn't anticipate crashing into on his motorcycle and dislocating his eye socket and all this yesterday, but it happened. Bill Clinton didn't anticipate a triple coronary bypass operation to save his life, but it happened. So we have to realize we need to be prepared. So this survival stuff is a powder. It is delicious. It tastes like cherry pineapple. It's got your proteins, your fatty acids, your probiotics. It's got your vitamins, your minerals. It's raw. It's all natural. It's big. And so then you are prepared. If you don't have an accident, you don't have an emergency, you don't have power out for 3 weeks up in, you know, up in Rochester and Syracuse and Buffalo, fine. Good. If you need it, you've got it. If you want a meal replacer, you've got it. Now, to help you, I also got together three of the best people I know in America, professors, on how to survive any disaster. I don't care what the disaster. Any and every disaster, you'll be able to survive. And these are three-hour CDs. For example, if it's a solar storm, how do you survive it? Where do you go? How do you get there? What do you wear? When do you leave? Because let's face it, the first several hours, everyone's just going to think the power's out. No, you walk outside. Power's out. You look up and down the streets. Everyone's looking up and down. What's going on? I don't know. You don't know because there's no radio, television, telephone to tell you. Except for the batteries in your cell phone, everything else is dead. And so it might take a day before people realize, hey, this is a bad situation. Where should I go? So we tell you where to go, what to take, what kind of knapsack, what kind of portable bicycle, what kind of foot gear, what kind of emergency kit in case you get a cut, scrape, some damage to your body, which is possible. And where do you go and how do you get there? Or if you can't go anywhere, how can you help yourself where you're at so at least you are not taken advantage of, rob, mug, your stuff, whatever you might have? Because the average American doesn't have more than 3 days worth of food. That's it. Well, that's not enough to help you if there's a long-term problem. Power survival stuff is. And the videos, the CDs tell you what to do. If there's an earthquake, a flood, a fire, and here's the irony of this, and then I'll close this out. I was on PBS in Denver, Channel 12, and I was talking about surviving, and the hostess said, Gary, this is not really something, let's stick with something else. And I stopped. Okay, and then afterwards she said, "You know, Gary, that you know, you got Vail, you got Aspen, you got Denver, you got Boulder, you know, we're happy. That stuff for someplace else." 2 weeks later, the biggest flood in Colorado history happened, and 3,000 homes were washed away—million-dollar homes in a valley through the biggest flood mudslide. And she called me back out there. Suddenly, oh yeah, now everybody wants to know about surviving CDs, right? Then suddenly got their attention, and it became the biggest hit of the year for them. So I hate to think that people are only going to pay attention when it happens to them, but let's get ahead of this. You've got survival stuff, this giant gallon of everything you need to keep yourself healthy and well-nourished. You don't have to worry about looking for the last potato chip behind a couch because you didn't think it would happen. Call this number and get your survival stuff. And by the way, because of Utrice Lead and because this is a fundraiser, we're making this whole deal. You're going to save $100 on this. If you regularly call in, it's $100 more. For Utrice's audience, when you call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, it's $150. That's $100 less than its retail price. That includes the giant jar of survival stuff, plus the three-hour CDs by the best experts on how to survive any disaster, any and every disaster. And if you want extra jars of survival stuff, those are only $132 each. So call today. It's supporting the station. It's supporting everything and supporting your health. Call for survival stuff, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And it's not, are we going to have a disaster in the future? It's when. Utrice?
Thank you so much, Gary. And do keep in mind that this is about supporting PRN, supporting the programming here, supporting Lead Stories as well. 877-627-5065. As always, a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.